Y'all don't need to worry about us trying to steal your job yet.
Hello, listener. You are so very welcome to episode 82 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. This month, we're talking about the growing role of technology in B2B content. We'll talk about the tools that can help you write better, and we'll meet the man who says his AI can write better copy than you can, for an email subject line at least. My name's David McGuire. I'm creative director at Radix Communications, and I'm joined by copywriter and content lead Katie Eddy.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
And for the last time, by our founder and CEO, Fiona Campbell-Howes. Fiona, 82 episodes. It's the end of an era.
It really is. And I quite like the fact that we're ending, or at least I'm ending, on the topic of subject lines, which was the topic of the first podcast we ever did.
So
I like neatness, and I'm a completer finisher in Belbin, so that appeals to me.
And out of those 82 episodes, anything jump out at you as a highlight?
Well, I was thinking back over, because that's kind of 7 years worth of episodes, and what jumps out at me is the way we used to record the podcast and the kind of sort of progressive sophistication we've had, because I think we started out, we had a cardboard fort at one point that we recorded the podcast in. I've got a photo of me and Emily recording the podcast under some chairs in our old meeting room. Some we did in Emily's car, because that was better soundproofing than we had anywhere in the office. So I don't know, and look at us now with our fancy pop shields, proper microphones.
Although I don't know, in some senses that's less sophisticated. We just have less stuff now.
So, 7 years is a long time to be going with a podcast.
It really is.
Yes. So it is a bit of an end of an era, yeah.
Yeah. And as you're moving on, I know the one thing the listener will be desperate to know is, what chair have you selected for your new office?
So I'm quite upset that you think that I might only have selected one chair.
Oh, what an... Now you say it, what an oversight.
I guess we assumed you'd have a favourite.
I counted up the chairs I've got for my new office, and I can seat 12 people. and there's only going to be me.
At first.
Well, who knows?
You can just move every half hour.
So what chairs have you selected for the purpose?
Well, I actually inherited... This is a really interesting story. It's not an interesting story at all. I inherited 9 chairs with this new office. I thought, oh, that's a bargain. But I really don't like the way they're upholstered, so I'll get them reupholstered.
Right.
And now, having got a quote for having them reupholstered and having bought the fabric, I could easily have got new chairs for a lot less. But they will be very nice, so I'm very, very much looking forward to having them.
Cool.
And you're all very welcome to come around and sit on them.
Oh, that's
anytime
that's,
you
that's
like.
That's very kind of you. And do you have a favourite of the remaining 3? Is there a special one?
No, there's no special chair, not yet.
Oh, you'll have to put that right.
Yeah.
You've got to earn their place as the favourite.
Exactly.
Fiona talks about chairs.
Listener, if you have any thoughts or comments to add, email us on podcast@radix-communications.com. You can find us on Twitter at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. As B2B copywriters, we tend to spend a lot of our time in Microsoft Word, but that's not the only piece of software out there that can help us with writing. And Katie is here to talk us through some of her favourite contenders. You've been around the block with writing software.
I mean, absolutely. I think in my spare time, I do incredibly bad novel writing. Therefore, I've tried every vague novel writing software out there. So I've done the Scriveners and the Storyboxes and the Y-Writers and so on and so forth. And to be honest, when you're actually writing words, I don't think there is anything better than Word, tragic as that is, because Word is full of faults. But I think there are a lot of little bits and pieces that you can go outside Word for. that okay. make everything a little bit easier.
Okay, I mean, like what?
So, this is really embarrassing because I'm now going to start with something that goes into Word. But we recently had some training from Lorraine of Lighthouse Proofing.
Lovely Lorraine. Hi, Lorraine.
Who introduced us to macros. And our very own George has been doing some digging into macros, and he found me a long sentence macro because I am famously bad for writing incredibly long sentences. And I think they're fine. Other people don't think they're fine.
It's not me. I love long sentences.
It's Matt. He did once sit me down after a review and go, Katie, this is a 50-word sentence, and that is what we call taking the piss. So that rapidly got split into several sentences. Mm-hmm. So a macro is just a little bit of code that goes into your into Word and essentially performs little tasks for you, and it can help you find repeated words, extra spaces, that kind of thing. And the long sentence one will find you anything over a specified number, so say 20 words, 30 words, and it'll highlight it for you, and then you can go back through and work out whether it's worth having that long sentence, because sometimes it is, or if you need to split it out into multiples. And I think that's really helpful, particularly for me. I think other people are probably better at mediating sentence length all by themselves.
So do you do that at the end when you've kind of done your first draft and you're checking it through, or is that something that you'll have it on, you know, a kind of a hotkey combination, and you'll just be running it as you go? Like I obsessively control S every 10 seconds while I'm writing so I don't lose anything.
That's quite retro. I miss doing that. Autosave's got me out of that habit. For me, I will get to the end of either an entire piece of copy or a section if I'm working on something bigger, and then run it on that section, because I don't want a constant reminder of how bad I am at writing varying sentence lengths.
And George says got a lot of this. We should do a blog post about mm-hmm. this at some point, I'm sure, listing all these out. But there's kind of repeated words, mm-hmm. Long sentences.
You can have ones for like really tiny things, like if you've double spaced in weird places, which I know is a bad habit for some people, uh-huh. Tends to turn up when it comes back for amends from places. Yeah. Really small things that I think people do habitually without noticing. There's basically one for everything. There's literally thousands of them.
Wow. So you can kind of pick and choose your own depending on your own, you know, what you know that your own strengths and weaknesses
are. Yeah. Everyone's got a bad habit. So it's about identifying those and giving yourself a little kick to fix them.
Cool. We should certainly share things about that. Fiona, have you got into the world of macros yet, or are you?
I haven't, but I wish I had, because you know, I was in that training as well with Lorraine, and when she started showing us what all these macros could do, I was like, this is amazing. I really need all of this, and I just haven't got around to installing them, so I really need to do that.
So what we should probably do for the time being, I'm sure Lorraine has some content about this somewhere, so we'll direct people to that for the time being, and then when we've got George's mega list together, maybe we'll do our own blog post as well. And Katie, you were saying there are some others outside of Word that you'd be looking at.
Yes. So I have a couple of others that I use quite extensively. So I know Evernote, everybody has come across Evernote at some point. But I think a lot of people tend to use it for organization away from writing. But for me, particularly working on bigger pieces, it has been massively helpful because I am obsessive about filing things and keeping things neat and together. And I find that really difficult when you're working on something massive, like particularly web copy projects, because they are a nightmare. I like having a checklist, essentially. And if I've got to go and make a spreadsheet for that, I don't care for it. But in Evernote, you can make lists with checkboxes that are associated with your project. So you can have a notebook that is dedicated to whatever you're working on, and then have a checkbox in there, which I think is really useful.
And is that a checkbox for things that you do, you know, that you needed to have done in mm-hmm. your copy? So check mm-hmm. it for this, check it for mm-hmm. that, and then you go back and...
Yeah, so you can make one for pretty much anything. Like if you know that you've got to write, say, X number of pages, you can have a checkbox for each of those when you go through it, and then for things you have to check back through to make sure you've hit SEO, that kind of thing.
Okay, cool. And how is that, you know, better than having like a piece of paper next
because
to your
I
desk?
Lose pieces of paper, David.
Fair.
I like having everything together, and I think because you can have Evernote notebooks where you can clip things straight from the internet, you can add images and that kind of thing, you can keep it all together. Because if I've got it all in 8 different places, I'm just dealing with clutter at that point.
Yeah, I've never really got to grips with Evernote. I know it's like a thing that, you know, that people use, and it's so versatile. I've always just used it for filing stuff that I'll never read again.
Yeah, I've tried to use it a couple of times, but never really got into it. I think I'm just basic, really. I mean, I just use Word and a notebook, like an actual physical notebook, and that's it.
Just keeping it old school.
Old school, that's right. Yeah,
you're such a hipster.
That is correct, David.
Any more tips for us, Katie?
I've got a final little nod, which was recommended to us by Rose Newell on Twitter.
Oh,
way
Rose
back
is
in
brilliant.
January 2019, I
oh,
think.
Oh, goodness.
There's a little bit of a callback for, and we think this is what it's called, but I'm not going to put money on it, the Abbey Screenshot Reader.
When you say you think that's what it's called.
It's ABBYY, and it's all caps, and I don't know how you say that. And I hope
hipsters.
Someone can correct me.
Oh, the 82nd podcast, and I can tell I've offended Fiona now.
I mean, if it took you 82 episodes, that's pretty good.
Well, I'm not saying it's the first time. So A, B, B, Y, Y. So
yes.
A, B.
Yes.
Okay. What does it do? There's the thing.
So they make, it's part of a wider PDF viewer and editor that they offer. But as I'm blessed with Adobe Acrobat Pro, I don't need to deal with that. But they do have this little thing, which is Screenshot Reader, which uses OCR, or Optical Character Recognition, to look at difficult formats to copy text out of them. So before I have received feedback on JPEGs from clients for copy edits, which is degenerate as far as I'm concerned, but it's really difficult then because your only option really is to go and type it all out again. But this, you can put PDFs, JPEGs, all that kind of thing. You screenshot it, you run it through there, their screenshot reader, and it'll copy all the text to the clipboard for you, so you can put it anywhere you like. And it's really cheap, which is nice. It's like £9, and you get a free trial. So
£9 forever, or like
£9
£9
forever. It is a one-off.
Wow.
Yeah. So you just get this like really handy little tool for when someone sends you a JPEG and asks you to edit it.
Well, it's probably worth that to not have to worry about that. Ever.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah, and that sounds really useful, because quite often we have clients come to us and they want a new website doing, and they all say, you know, well, as a starter, take the copy from the existing website. And you go to the existing website and the copy is all in images.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, and you end up just like typing all that out again. So that sounds really useful for that.
Oh, that's helpful. Fiona, are there any particular bits of kind of software or apps that you find support apart from Word and a notebook?
Nope.
No, there's all kinds of software and apps that I think sound like they would be really useful, but I never end up using them. So it's just Word and my notebook for me.
Fair enough. The one that I'm finding really helpful at the moment, and I find myself using all the time, I know it's kind of controversial, but is Otter AI, the AI transcription service. Like the, it's not like you can load a call into it and you'll get the transcription will be good enough that you can use it as copy. But I find it's very good that it's close enough that I can put a keyword in there and go straight to the bit of the call that is about that. And the transcription is time synced to the to the audio. So you just click on the word and it starts playing. So if there's a bit where it's not clear what it's meant to be, which is quite often, depending on the quality of the audio, you can at least hear it and hear what they say. And I find that for manipulating case study calls and things is really helpful.
Oh, okay. That sounds useful. I hadn't started using it like that. I might sort of up my estimation of Otter AI from that, because I've been finding it almost completely unusable. Just the quality of the transcription. It's not there yet.
No, it's really not. And particularly where you've got company names and they are, you know, revealed in, you know, various different ways. You know, I've got, you know, quite a list of words when someone says Radix, you know, what it comes out as. But I do find it helpful just to go, okay, I can find a sentence that's about that, and then I can write that or edit it slightly or whatever. But yeah, it's certainly not something that you could pick up and use wholesale. You know, every fourth or fifth word is
not yet. No. But hopefully they will improve that over time, because that will be so useful when that's actually functional. That will be brilliant.
Sure. And the other thing, I've not managed to get it to work yet because of admin privileges of one kind or another. But apparently you can plug it into Zoom. So you do your Zoom call and you get live transcription as it happens, which, again, I imagine is a very, very useful thing to have, rather than, you know, thinking, oh, yes, I should probably go this, feed it into the machine and then it take a few minutes.
Yeah, it's very useful, because I'm the sort of person that when I'm interviewing somebody, I have to see the words written down. Otherwise it kind of goes out of my head and I can't remember what they just said. So yeah, that live transcription for conference calls is really useful for me.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know how quick it is, but yeah, hopefully almost real time. Yeah. One of the other big areas where tech looks set to affect copywriting is the rise of AI writing bots. Already big B2C brands like Domino's and eBay are using AI like Phrasy to write email subject lines, apparently with better results than human copywriters can get. But how will it affect us in B2B? I caught up with Phrasy CEO Parry Malm and I asked him, can your AI really write better copy than I can?
Well, it depends what kind of copy we're actually talking about. So if we're talking about, you know, writing overarching strap lines and positioning statements, absolutely not, because that requires, you know, a huge amount of skill and knowledge to actually understand how to do that. But if we're talking about writing copy for fast-moving campaigns that proliferate across channels, across the internet, then absolutely an AI can write better than humans. And this shouldn't be some sort of existential concern, because generally that's not the kind of writing that copywriters want to be doing in the first place.
Okay, so the message, you know, to the copywriters who are listening is, this isn't necessarily going to take your job. It's just going to take the bit of the job that you don't want to do.
Well, yeah. So like the way I'd think about it, you know, what a lot of people think about when they think about AI is they think about it very, very adversarially. It's coming to take my job. It's going to make me redundant. All of these kind of concerns. But I think that's thinking about it the wrong way. And the way that people should think about it is much like how designers think about Photoshop. You know, while in principle, Photoshop is there to like remove the need for specialist designers and whatnot because it democratizes access to advanced tools, what it actually does is it empowers designers to be much more effective at their jobs. That's what technology like Phrasy does. It doesn't replace copywriters whatsoever. It just allows them to be more effective at their jobs in specific types of copywriting.
Oh, cool. So is that a thing that what jobs are there that the AI should handle and that copywriters should kind of use an AI for? And what jobs are there currently that definitely a human would be better suited doing?
Yeah, so the way to think about it is this, is that if you have to, you know, effectively write the same kind of thing, like say 2, 3, 4, 5, 100 times, then there's a fundamental inefficiency in a human undertaking that task. So let's take the bane of the majority of copywriters' existence, the humble email subject line. Now, I've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of copywriters since founding Phrasy about 5 years ago. And I asked them, you know, do you enjoy writing email subject lines? And pretty much every single one who I've spoken to hates doing it. And that's because of a couple of reasons. Number one, it's not very glamorous to write a subject line. But number two, it's the one form of copy that everybody from the janitor to the CEO has opinions on, where everybody's written a subject line. We all think that we know how we can do it better and all this kind of stuff. So where Phrasy comes into it is for those sort of repeatable tasks that, you know, aren't necessarily worth a copywriter's time to do, but need to be done at a high frequency, at a high volume across multiple, you know, channels and touch points. That's where an AI is best suited. Now, for the type of copy that requires a huge amount of, you know, creative thought and sort of humanity instilled into it. So think, you know, your longer form copy, positioning statements, strap lines, things like that. That's where humans should really focus their time.
So, but is that something where that's just, will that always be the case? Or is that something where, you know, the things are changing and it's just based upon what an AI can do right now? I mean, can you see a future where AI is writing kind of more of that more complicated stuff?
I think we are a couple of fundamental technological advances away from that being the case. So like the thing is, you know, it's possible for machines now to take a huge amount of input data and then hallucinate a coherent text. But it's rudderless, a contextually irrelevant text, and it's hallucinated by an AI. It can't follow any form of pattern or business narrative. And we're still, you know, a couple of big, you know, fundamental innovations away from this actually being possible. Now, I'm not saying that it'll never happen, but one thing I've learned, and I've run this company for 5 years, the technical advances that we've made in those 5 years still boggle my mind, let alone our customers' minds. I've learned to like not predict too far out in the future, because as soon as I say something ain't going to happen, it'll happen the next day.
Talking about the subject lines that you were talking about for kind of dominoes and others, I've read some of those, and the thing that I was really surprised about is I thought I would be able to spot which ones were written by AI really easily because you know, being able to use, you know, imagery or, you know, or metaphor or humor and all of those things that you think of as being kind of human traits. But some of those subject lines are kind of, that come out of the AI are kind of quite creative. Is that something that the AI is learning from human writers? How does that happen?
Well, fundamentally, all output from AI is based upon some level of human input. I mean, like every AI system on the planet has training data going into it. So I guess, you know, the language that Phrasy generates is ultimately derived from stuff which humans write. But it is purely generated on demand by the machine itself. But to your point about, you know, thinking that you could spot the machine one versus the human one, this is actually a much harder task than people think. And I think it comes down to this sort of unique human condition called illusory superiority. We all think that, you know, oh, of course, as humans, there's something so unique about the human condition, a machine could never replicate it. And we sort of really believe that because it's tied to our whole sort of sense of existential importance. But when you get down to it and you run the experiments at scale, humans at scale cannot differentiate human written lines to machine written lines, which is cool, but it doesn't actually matter. What matters is that the language is getting you more opens and more clicks and more conversions, regardless of who wrote it.
Sure. But the machine can't tell you what's funny. The machine can write something that's funny, but not necessarily know that it's funny. It just knows that it works. How does it, is it kind of generating patterns and then comparing them using an algorithm based upon what it has seen generate results in the past?
Yeah, so basically, the system we've built use a few different methods. So we use, you know, a supervised learning method, which has a huge amount of inputted data, where the input is a given subject line, for example, and then its associated open and click rates. And from that, it can derive patterns which are imperceptible to the human eye. Now, you probably could sort of, you know, break down some of the machine's reasoning into these human developed concepts of humor or of, you know, sparking various emotional or semantic triggers, or using linguistic formations like onomatopoeia or something like that. But the machine doesn't really care. This is just, you know, these are just heuristics that humans have created in their minds over the years to make sense of the confusing world surrounding us. But if you get down to it, it doesn't really matter if a human perceives it as being funny or not. What matters is that it works.
Sure. So, and on that basis, the machines are kind of viewing it at that data level. It's not so simple then as saying, and the algorithm has worked out that the best way to get a click is to do this and this and this. And then, so a human can't learn then from the AI.
Well, I guess if we wanted to deconstruct our deep learning engine, we probably could. You know, we've got thousands and thousands of different parameters which it looks at, and each of them have different neurons in the neural net architecture and whatnot. You probably could sort of separate all of those, but if a human were to look at it, it would be far too much information for a human to take in. Like if you think about, you know, if you write, say, 10 different subject lines, right? Each of those subject lines has hundreds of different features within it. You know, it's going to be about the length, the word choice, the punctuation, the semantics, the syntax, the structure, phonology, all these sort of different linguistic concepts. And so if you were to actually like break them all down into a set of, you know, ones and zeros or pluses and minuses, then what could a human really do with that? It's too much information to really comprehend. And that's why humans aren't particularly well suited at writing large volumes of copy that's effective at scale. And that's exactly why machines are very well suited to it, because they can take in all this information and not have it obfuscated by human bias or by these concepts of like illusory superiority or the sort of unconscious incompetence humans get when doing the same thing over and over. It seems like these days, you know, every 6 months people want a shiny new thing, but it takes time for like technology to be adopted, and it takes time for people to really get to grips with what it can do. We're in a really exciting period at Frazee because the sort of crescendo is building. And what's really exciting about that is more and more people realize that these sort of AI technologies aren't out to take your job. They're just out to make you better at your job.
On the podcast, you're talking to B2B copywriters, B2B marketers in the UK and around the world. What would you like to tell them?
Well, first of all, Frazee is not focused on optimizing B2B copywriting. We're focused on sort of big ticket B2C companies and optimizing their sort of mass marketing messages. So y'all don't need to worry about us trying to steal your job yet.
yet.
But one thing that I found, this is just a personal bugbear, is that most B2B copywriting is just so friggin' boring. I mean, you'll get sent, you know, a download link to a white paper. It'll be a 4-page sort of thinly veiled sales brochure about a topic, and you'll download it. And by the time you finish reading it, you know less about the topic than before you downloaded that damn thing, right? And it just seems as though everybody is getting on to this big sort of content driven race to the bottom, where we all produce so much throwaway content, it just turns into one big blah. Us at Frazee, we've taken a different standpoint where, first of all, our big mantra is to never be boring. Because I think it's too easy to just go, we're a B2B marketing company, and so we need to like be very professional and very buttoned up and this and that. But the thing is, like, the people who are buying your stuff, they're still humans too. So there's nothing stopping you from actually adding a level of humanity to your brand. That's how I think you stand out in a B2B marketplace.
Thanks, Parry. And it's reassuring to hear that there's a role for humanity in B2B copy yet. Fiona, what struck you about the interview?
I think it's quite good to hear Parry saying the same things that we've been thinking about, you know, where AI is going and what it is capable of doing in copywriting at the moment. Mm. I think we were talking about it on the podcast last time, which was, you know, we understand that AI is sort of able now to do some of those like small discrete tasks like writing subject lines, which means that we as copywriters need to up our game a bit. Mm. The bits that Parry was talking about that AI can't do is like sort of the brand positioning and the sort of meaningful narrative for your whichever persona you're writing for. So it just means, I think, that we as copywriters can't really rest on our laurels. We need to look for other ways to add value. And, you know, that's what we've been doing here, certainly by, you know, appointing our consultant writers and getting more into the kind of consultancy side of writing as well. So.
And Katie, Parry was talking about... in time, writers coming to view AI like designers think of mm-hmm. Photoshop and things like that. Mm-hmm. Did that sort of ring true for you? Can you see that happening?
I can, actually, because I've done quite a lot of graphic design, and I understand how important the kind of democratization of it is, I guess. It's easier, I think, from a design perspective to look at Photoshop as a tool than it is for writers to look at AI as a tool. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably still an inherent suspicion of AI and also just skepticism. But I think as this kind of continues and gets more sophisticated, I think we'll probably move towards that.
And do you think the things like we were talking about with the macros, where the computer can give you just more and more of a helping hand as you go. Do you think that might sort of be a way into it?
Yeah, definitely. I think anything that can make our lives a little bit easier, I think, is really important. And I think the important thing to remember is we can always pick and choose personally what we use these things for. And if you don't want to give up a certain bit of your job to an AI tool, you just don't have to.
You know, it's an acronym. You'd be like an American that drives a stick shift.
Oh, yeah.
Have either of you had much to do with Grammarly and tools like that? I know that's something that a lot of copywriters kind of like to use as like a backstop. But personally, I've just found it quite annoying, and I'd quite like to uninstall it now, please.
Yeah, I won't touch it.
I'm not having it either. I'll let Word underline things, but I'll usually ignore what it's underlined. But
I find it so hard to ignore it when Word has underlined something, and Word has taken to underlining commas before ands and things, and it's just like, but I want that comma there.
Yeah, right click, ignore always.
Yeah, maybe I'll do that.
Yeah.
I do spend quite a long time arguing with it about like subject verb disagreement. I'm like, you're just not reading the sentence right, I swear.
Oh, yeah, it was the other day it was trying to tell me that the plural of spacecraft was spacecrafts.
I sort of wish it was. When it's quite cute.
We all know it's spaces craft. Before we go, we just have time for the Anonymous Five, our shortcut into the head of key B2B personas. This month, we're talking to a chief technology officer at a digital development startup. The Anonymous Five. Question one. What makes you a CTO and not, say, a CIO or a CDO? Do the titles actually mean anything?
It's fundamentally the focus on finding the best use of technology to support the business objectives, but the scale of an organization will blur the lines. In early stage startups, the lead developer will sometimes identify as the CTO, but they'll also cover much of the CIO, CDO and in some cases CPO. Usually only larger organizations have defined boundaries and responsibilities between these roles.
Question 2.
Do you actively look for new technologies and trends, or are you kept too busy in the day-to-day?
I've got a keen interest in technology and will spend time researching emerging trends. As my team and organization grow, some of this would be deferred as other priorities may take precedence, such as C-level reporting or compliance.
Question 3.
What would a really crappy day at work look like? What's the worst thing that could happen?
A crappy day would probably involve some form of system outage, resulting in downtime for the end users. Most CTOs I know started as very hands-on technical people, in many cases directly fixing system problems and getting things back online. So when you're a CTO and there's a problem, you're in a position where you aren't in direct control. Your team is responsible for the fix, and you've got to report back at a business level on the outage. That took me a while to get used to, and why it's probably the worst thing that can happen for me as a CTO.
Question 4.
What was the last piece of tech content that you actually paid any attention to, and why?
I usually look out for the Stack Overflow yearly developer survey. It's a good summary of the emerging and growing technologies. It also provides great insight into developer mindsets and salaries. If you see a certain technology on the decline, that might impact your decision to use it.
And question 5.
What's the worst, most cliched, or most patronizing thing you've seen in a piece of marketing?
I do recall seeing some recruitment-based marketing that was too close to programmer culture, and I find this the worst and very damaging to our industry. It's especially important that the content and message promotes inclusivity so we can look to a more diverse future for the tech industry.
The Anonymous 5.
Many thanks to our CTO for your time, and we're pleased to say we've made a donation to Children's Hospice Southwest on your behalf. All being well, we'll be talking to a senior procurement officer next time out. Fiona, any surprises there for you from the CTO?
Well, I don't know about surprises, but, you know, quite relieved to hear that something we'd written wasn't among things they'd found patronising.
always nice to always slightly feel yes. You dodged a bullet with that question.
Yeah, and great to hear that, you know, they want to kind of foster a more inclusive, approach in the role. And that's something that we as writers can definitely help with when we're talking about that role, as we've discussed previously when we were talking about the gender say gap. So, you know, we can actually talk about the role of the CTO as being a completely gender inclusive role and not fall into the trap of like talking about the IT guy, he does this. So that's an area where we can definitely help.
And it's nice now that we've actually got this and asked someone the question and done that research, so that, you know, we can, you know, in talks with, you know, briefs of stakeholders or clients and that kind of thing, we can help to steer them away from that as well, on the basis of more than it's just the right thing to do. Katie, what stood out for you?
Firstly, I was kind of shocked that it's taken me this long to come across the word programmer, and I hate it, and I never want to see it again. But on a more serious note, I think it was useful to have a bit of a reminder that some CTOs are still really hands-on in their companies, because I think when you get used to working with massive enterprises, you assume that they're just hugely removed from everything that goes on the ground with their people. But you've got to remember that some people are, you know, rolling their sleeves up and getting right in there with the technical stuff as well.
Yeah, I suppose that's where they've come from as well, even in the bigger companies. So, you know, if they're not doing that, they might be frustrated that they're not.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
And that really is all we have time for this episode. Next time, we'll be talking about lean, agile content and welcoming back a familiar voice. Emily's coming back as guest co-host. If you'd like to get in touch, you can send us a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com or find us on Twitter @radixcom. And if you'd like to keep in touch, sign up for updates and writing advice at radix-communications.com/insights. But Fiona, after 7 years of podcasts, the next episode will be our first without you as co-host. And we couldn't let that pass without marking that in some way. So we do have a short clip of your greatest hits on the podcast. I'm afraid so.
This is your life.
It's going to be very
podcast
short.
Edition.
Welcome to episode one of the Radix Copycast. Here we'll be discussing some of the current trends and issues in B2B technology copywriting. I'm Emily.
I'm Fiona.
And today we're going to be talking about email marketing, because there's still too many bad habits out there. And we're also going to have a look at video, because apparently 2013 is going to be the year of video.
Some of the things that we see talked about as storytelling aren't really storytelling in the true sense of the word. So I've seen, for example, things like unboxing videos described as storytelling, or presenting an infographic in the way that it looks a bit like a Facebook timeline as storytelling. I just think that thinking of those things as stories is probably missing some of the point as to what an engaging story actually is. So I just think they're dull, and I think companies could do a lot more to, with their case studies, to make them more engaging. That's the future of B2B interviewing, yeah.
There will be no contact at all except through robots.
Hi, Fiona, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. It says here that we're now going to have some top banter, hopefully.
Okay.
Whereas I might start off with like terrible pain and shame and embarrassment, our colleague Matt, for example, goes straight to righteous fury, extreme anger.
I think we should perhaps take a little moment to reminisce about some of the places that this podcast has been recorded from, but like...
Under tables.
We used to build a cardboard fort every time
we recorded
the podcast.
Was that the pod yurt?
We had a yurt, yes. The back of your car.
Back of my car.
Your car.
My son's bedroom.
Yes.
All in the quest for audio that might not, you know, make your ears bleed.
It might be really unfashionable, but I just don't agree with that at all.
I've kind of dubbed it hyper-specificity.
It's easy
for
you to say.
Yeah. It's the most unpronounceable next big thing name ever.
We've kind of seen predictions that video is going to take off in B2B over the last couple of years, but I think it's just now that it's really starting to happen. I think for the last 3 years, it's always going to have been the year of video in B2B, and it's always going to be taking off this year. And I always say, we haven't really seen much of it, and it's always a bit of a damp squib.
We once recorded our podcast under some chairs.
I'd love to say that I had weird and wonderful messaging workshop stories. I feel like I'm running a global multinational.
I have got information and expertise to share.
Absolutely. It's definitely putting yourself in the shoes of the audience and looking at what words do they understand and what words do they use.
Making it bite-sized might actually obscure what it's about and just, you know, was it sort of reductio ad absurdum or something? Sorry, I'm actually using Latin. There you go. You've condensed something down so far that the words you're left with don't actually make any sense.
Yeah. Sorry, I had a thing to say to that, and then the Latin thing completely threw me.
That's the first time I've ever used Latin on the podcast, in a podcast about writing in plain English.
Oh, the irony.
I'm a iconoclast.
Sorry for doing that to you, Fiona.
Thank you for that.
It is quite the moment, being the last of 82 podcasts for you. Do you have any final words of wisdom that you'd like to share with the listener?
I don't know about wisdom. But, you know, when Emily and I started the podcast in 2013, I thought, this will last for like 5 episodes and then we'll run out of things to talk about. And here we are 7 years later, episode 82, and we still haven't run out of things to talk about. So that just makes me realise that the job of B2B copywriter and B2B marketer is a really, really complex one. And it just makes me think that, you know, this is a really hard job. And those of us that do it are quite amazing for doing this job, because there's so much to do and so much to get your head around that, yeah, I think we should all give ourselves a pat on the back.
Well said.
Thank you.
So, Fiona, on behalf of the listener and ourselves, obviously, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope you'll have me back one day.
Oh, I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will. And of course, best of luck with the new venture.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
I'm just going to cry gently for a minute.
I'm really going around the corner.